Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. Thanks for listening in. If you'd like to call in, you can call area code 267-521-0167. Grab a pen, because we're going to have lots of information all night long. Area code 267-521-0167. Or if you need a toll-free line, the number to call toll-free in the United States is area code 855-346-3351. Toll-free line, 855-346-3351. And first-time callers are more than welcome. This is an open line show, so you can call to talk about anything you're interested in. I put together I put together a little article about the last month of what my learning has been like with this show, and I will talk about that in a few minutes. But I want to give some good news, because when do we ever really get, like, really super good news? And so there were tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people who were paying attention to what was happening to Justina Pelletier in Massachusetts. And on June 17th, 2014, an article came out on The Blaze. And it says, judge orders Massachusetts DCF to return Justina Pelletier to her parents. And this was written by Jason Howarden. And so he writes that a juvenile court has ordered the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families to return Justina Pelletier to her parents, the Boston Globe reports. And the judge is letting Justina go home, and it's my understanding that she will be home with her parents and her sisters and her family by Wednesday morning. And so for all of you who have been working on the Free Justina campaign, the pound Free Justina tag, hashtag Free Justina campaign, and a miracle for Justina, and who have been calling attention to the travesty of what this family faced, and how Child Protective Services came in and nabbed this young person from her family, denied her true medical access for a medical condition, suggested that it was something quote-unquote psychiatric, quote-unquote somatoform disorder, and had her locked in a institution for over a year and a half. This is what a horrifying thing to have survived, but Justina will be returned home to her family on Wednesday morning. And I think that this is so important for people to see that people can get out, and that rationality can overcome the fraud, the absolute fraud of psychiatry. And so for anybody who's been working on it, who wants to talk about it, other situations, I think one of the things that's very important to remember is that while all of this attention and justified attention went to Free Justina, there are so many young people and families in this country and across the world that are going through this exact same situation, and that if a psychiatrist deems the situation to be that a parent isn't suitable in whatever way, shape, or form, or that it's medical neglect, if a parent chooses to not take the route of psychiatry with their child, that their child can be taken away from them, this is a crime, and this needs to be stopped, and we need to keep attention on the practice and the structure here, because this is institutional, But congratulations, Lou Pelletier and your family and really, Justina, congratulations for pushing through and for speaking out. And I saw you speaking, Justina, on a video to the judge, and your voice, I'm sure, led him to make this decision and, keep fighting. And so, yeah, good news. Justina Pelletier will be returned to her family by Wednesday morning. And then if you want to call in and talk about anything, area code 521, I'm sorry, area code 261-521-0167. Area code 267-521-0167. I also, mentioned earlier that I was putting together some of the reflections that I had on what this show was and what it's been about. And so, it really happened in the middle of the night one night when I was sitting here trying to figure out what I was going to do now that I've graduated. And I, registered and did it and set up the account and set up the show. And one of the motivating factors, though, was because of the DuVoiced research that so many people were involved in, and I'm so thankful to them all, especially Lester Cook and Aubrey Ellen Shomo in their roles as study coordinators, and all the other study coordinators, Celia Brown, D.K. Cawkins, Kathy Cassio, and Amy Colsanti, and all of the people who participated and evaluated and advised and listened to me talk about this for 10 years, literally. I'm so appreciative of, but one of the main findings of DuVoiced was that when people speak out against the biomedical model of psychiatry, especially if they're in a, peer role, that they're silenced and retaliated against. And that silencing ranged from losing position in an organization, losing power, losing access, losing the ability to make one's own schedule, losing the ability to send out emails without them having to be first reviewed, all the way to then being fired or being put in a position of where they had no choice but to leave because of the emotional strife and the damage, the iatrogenic damage that was being done to them through the employment agreement, all the way to being institutionalized and force drugged based on the research that we did. And I think that this is a major issue that really needs some attention as to when people are working in peer roles, that they're being silenced and retaliated against by very often the government or, a organization or an institution in the community who is whose funding would be put in jeopardy if they spoke out in these ways. And I think one of the things that really was highlighted by David Oakes in the DuVoiced process was that in the early days, the government didn't fund activism and advocacy, and that government doesn't fund it, and that we did it ourselves, and that there's something to be said for being independent of state funding, and that when you're in these jobs, as Ted Chepzinski has said, you can do advocacy up until a certain point if you're in one of these peer roles, but advocacy doesn't necessarily include dismantling the psychiatric system. And so, there's a line as to how far people can go. And so I wanted to really try to create an independent media stream, a place where we could challenge in the public eye and in public view these things that psychiatry does to people, all people. I mean, everyone is at risk for this, starting at 0 years old, where, it's like legal to put a 3-year-old on Haldol or other drugs at younger ages before a child's even able to talk. And so we need a place in the media where we can reach out to people and talk to them about the perception of psychiatry from people who have survived it or who are actively working to get out of it, whether that be because they're involuntarily involved or because they're titrating down off of these drugs, which in the informed consent process, people are rarely informed that that there's a withdrawal process in addition to it. Line 646, your line is open.
Hey, Lauren, how are you?
I'm good. How are you? Lester Cook.
All right. Not so much. What are you doing with yourself?
I am talking about my reflections on 1 month of having done this now. And I put together a little thing, and I'm hoping that it's going to wind up getting published. But I think for listeners, you know, I was talking about how after the D-Voice research, which you and others were part of, and did you hear me?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. So that's what I was talking about, and that the point of this show was really to try to get to the mainstream media. So I put together, like, that how amazed I am by the response of what's happened. And so in the first month of this show, which is on most nights from 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern, if you're a new listener, the show has been listened to over 3,000 times. We've had dozens of callers and two specials on electroshock. And so I put together the guests from the United States and Canada have included people who are psychiatric survivors, users of psychiatry, advocates, activists, life coaches, peer workers, spiritualists, veterans, authors of books and articles on psychiatry and anti-psychiatry, psychologists who work to expose psychiatry, and those who have stumbled over the show calling in to learn about these human rights violations that psychiatry commits, which they thought were long-ended. And so, like, as far as, like, a range of people who have called in, I think it's really, like, covering all of this. And so then I started looking. I keep notes every night, and I started looking through my notes, and it was really overwhelming. And so two main themes people call in to talk about are the pain that people experience because of their involvement with psychiatry and ways they have worked to overcome that pain. People who are survivors of all kinds of human rights violations, including electroshock, forced drugging, restraints, seclusion, and aversive behavior modification, involuntary institutionalization, and involuntary outpatient commitment, call in and share intimate details about their lives, the torture and abuse they have been subjected to, and a desire to reach others who may be struggling to let them know that they're not alone. The topics that callers called in to talk about over the last month include, but are not limited to, electroshock, psychiatric drugs, psychiatric drugging of children, involuntary outpatient commitment and community treatment orders, laws and pending legislation such as H.R. 3717, state policy and regulation, restraints, seclusion, and aversives, psychiatric profiling, police killing people who are psychiatrically labeled and police as first responders, politics, the mental patients liberation movement of the 1960s to the 1980s, 1985 really, the peer industry, protection and advocacy, LGBTQI2SA and psychiatry, oppression, discrimination, and overrepresentation of people of color involved with court-ordered psychiatry, alternatives, holistic medicine, homeopathy, anti-psychiatry, social control, psychiatric labeling, preventive detention, confronting NAMI and TAC, peer certification and Medicaid billable peer services, spiritual alternatives, relationships, support networks, civil rights, human rights, constitutional rights, patient rights, psychiatric malpractice, RICO lawsuits, the Racketeering-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, HIPAA and tips for obtaining your medical records and litigation purposes, as well as continued mention by guests of organizations and resources such as Soteria House, Hearing Voices Network, Engaging Women in Trauma-Informed Peer Support Guidebook, the harm reduction guides coming off psychiatric drugs, a wealth of information from the Law Project for Psychiatric Rights, Mind Freedom International, ECT Justice, End of Shock, the Electroshock Quotationary, and a wealth of information from Mad in America.
Wow.
Yeah. And then, you know, it continues to talk about, like, upcoming specials that we're going to be having. And it's like, and despite all this, I write, like, before each show starts, I get a knot in my stomach and I experience a wave of nausea, still afraid that I'm going to be caught out there talking to myself for 2 hours in public, which can be a dangerous game, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for calling in. What do you want to talk about?
Well, I think you pretty much covered the gamut. It's funny, I'm currently in a New York City homeless shelter, and I was coming up tonight through with my dinner because the food here is horrific. We've had some mild food poisoning since. And all of a sudden I'm walking up, and there was a guard, you know, one of the security guards, patrolling the hallway, and you hear her beginning to recite Bible verses as I'm walking through the hallway. And I said to myself, now, could you imagine if this was one of us walking through a homeless shelter hallway reciting Bible verses, what they would do? How quickly they would call the mobile crisis team, because they would be overly concerned that we were having some kind of spiritual experience and that we could, and that God was talking to us.
It really
made me stop.
Yeah, it's really interesting that you bring that up, because an article came out today, I think it was today or maybe yesterday, I'm not sure when it came out, recently, in Alternet, Diane sent it over. The results are in, America is dumb and on the road to getting dumber. And they explained that there was a Gallup poll released, and 42% of Americans still believe God created human beings in their present form less than 10,000 years ago. And the idea that spirituality and religion and God gets all mished up in politics and every other which way of how people present things is really concerning to me on a lot of levels. But the idea that a spiritual, if 42% of Americans still believe God created human beings in their present form less than 10,000 years ago, according to this article, and you can get locked up because you're having a spiritual experience.
There you go.
So I think that it's deeply problematic, but I'm sure that this extends beyond a Judeo-Christian framework, and anybody who's muttering any kind of prayer to themselves anywhere, regardless of what that prayer is, probably is immediately become suspect.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of psychiatrizing.
And then, of course, today, Debbie found an article in the New York Times, made the front page of the Times, as a matter of fact, and the title read, Debbie about fell over when she found it, because it was at the national, front page.
Mm-hmm.
And the title of said article was, and I about fell over when I read the stats, Thinking of Ways to Harm Her, New Findings on Timing and Rage of Maternal Mental Illness.
Oh, wow.
By Pam Fellick.
So, as I try to pull this up, can you just read the top line?
The title is Thinking of Ways to Harm Her, New Findings on Timing and Range of Maternal Mental Illness by Pam Bellock. postpartum depression isn't always postpartum, isn't even always depression. A fast-growing body of research is changing the very definition of maternal mental illness, showing that there is more common and varied than previously thought. Scientists say new findings contradict the longstanding view that symptoms begin only within a few weeks after childbirth. In fact, depression often begins during pregnancy, researchers say, and can develop any time in the first year after a baby is born.
That was a late duh.
Research studies also show that the range of disorders women face is wider than previously thought. In the past year, giving birth studies suggest at least 1 in 8 and as many as 1 in 5 women develop symptoms of depression, anxiety, bipolar disorder, compulsive disorder, or a combination. In addition, predicting who might develop these illnesses is difficult. Scientists say, while studies are receiving clues as to who is most vulnerable, there are often cases that appear to come out of nowhere. As public awareness has grown, often spiking after a mother kills herself or her baby, dozens of states, including Illinois, New Jersey, Texas, and Virginia, have passed laws encouraging education and treatment. New York and others are considering action. The Federal Affordable Care Act contains provisions to increase research, diagnosis, and care for maternal mental illness.
If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167. And the toll-free line, 855-346-3351. Postpartum depression. I guess this is another thing we can add, although I'm sure people have talked about this before. It is the lack of science that is available, and the way that they are, you know, who can be predicted to do so. I wish I had the article in front of me because I would love to tear this apart piece by piece. But I will say that there, you know, the conditioning and the, as Yvonne says, the coupling of violence and mental health and how we have to uncouple this. But it's conditioning. How would they otherwise be able to sell such a story if they didn't call back the horrors of the acts of, you know, a few people? And now where everyone.
And just in case you're wondering, let me go you one better. There's a TED Talk at Caltech. There is a researcher who is a biologist and a geneticist, and he has decided he's going to play with the brains of fruit flies because there was a whole discussion on the psychiatric drugs that he does, talking about the side effects and how unpleasant they are, and most people don't want to take them, and that they cause, he does admit, they cause long-term harm and things like that. And then proceeds to turn around and talk about targeting the very specific parts of the brain and how they've done things with genetics and with targeting specific to reconnect or disconnect certain neurotransmitters. I about fell over when I watched the TED Talk.
You know, it
all
really
sounds like genetic.
It really on fruit flies, right? So not even, you know. So I think that we're in such a dangerous place right here, and the idea that anything is going to be anything is capable of being diagnosable, and as psychiatric. I mean, where are things like economic realities or support or, you know, those kinds of things we're coming in that may cause a woman who is pregnant or just having a baby to be stressed out?
Absolutely.
I mean, this is like, you know, you're supposed to, like, be, you know, painted and prettied and, you know, the 1950s version of a woman is all that's being, what do you mean she's not smiling every second? So I think that this is also in terms of how women are still faced with so much misogyny that it plays a role in it, and it's part of it. And certainly...
Well, that was kind of like the first thing I felt, was that, you know, my biggest issue was that this was done. You know, this was my first kind of upset. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I was upset because I was like, there's still a misogynist thing that runs through this. There's still that.
Absolutely.
You know?
Even when you look at like the 1950s advertising of electroshock for women, for example, that you can wipe out somebody's memory and have it, you know, restored, and that they're giving that, like, NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, encourages the use of electroshock on women who are pregnant who have been diagnosed with bipolar.
Right.
It's really very dangerous. So I found the article. Okay. They're arguing that it extends all the way during the pregnancy, and what do they recommend?
Well, I didn't get a chance to read the entire thing. What I did read left me baffled, so to speak, if that makes any sense to you. And I just saw it as labeling that shouldn't be done. I mean, for me personally, that's how I saw it. Because it, they were talking about supports, they were talking about treatment, they were talking about, you know, all kinds of things. But, you know, my folks who all voted for President Barack Obama and now live with the Affordable Care Act, that's one of the consequences of what's happened with us.
They are pushing screening, and so apparently it says, I'm just looking at this piece here, so it says state legislatures respond. As more states pass laws relating to postpartum depression, the only hope is to catch problems early. Symptoms are frequently treatable, though finding effective medication or therapy can take time. Only New Jersey requires screening under a 2006 law championed by Mary Jo Cody, the state's first lady who had postpartum depression. The New York Times article says that mandate has drawn mixed reviews. A study in New Jersey of poor women on Medicaid found that required screening has not resulted in more women being treated. Katie Cousin-Manel, a University of Minnesota public health professor and an author of the study, said the law educated pediatricians and obstetricians but did not compensate them for the screening. There are also not enough treatment options. If a woman, Dr. Cousin-Manel says, if a woman comes with a baby and it's a place treating people with substance use or severe mental illness, she may be uncomfortable. So just add that extra, you know, discrimination in. So in New York State, Senator Liz Krueger has introduced a bill to encourage screening and own Senator Liz Krueger, what are you doing? Has introduced a bill to encourage screening and treatment, a proposal that will most likely pass and be approved by Governor Cuomo, who vetoed a 2013 bill on grounds but encouraged the revised legislation. So there's a bill right now. I wonder what's happening, because there's only like 3 days left of session. But this idea of you know, encouraging early intervention and screening, and the idea of drugs and you know, NAMI's push for electroshock on women who are pregnant is just pretty horrifying. Area code 609, your line is open?
Yeah, this is Jason from New Jersey.
Hey, Jason.
I'm listening. Hi. I'm just thinking about the word, they use the word screening, you know, mental health screening. And I'm thinking that's just not the right word. I'm thinking interrogation is a better is a better term, because you know, you can screen for real diseases, but you know, the mental health screening is really you know, these are just questions, and this doesn't make sense. And you mentioned the other night about you know, how psychiatry and how they work, it really is like a cancer, you know, eating away at healthy tissue, at, you know, behaviors that are healthy. They may be disturbing to people, but, you know, how can they say that these are unhealthy behavior? You know, a woman, these like pre-screenings or, I don't know, you know, in the months before the actual pregnancy, and they want to detect these things sooner with you know, using these questions, these screenings.
Right, and they're so dangerous,
really,
and the DSM,
yeah,
you know, the way they write about it, they say, so this article says, scientific understanding has come a long way and continues to evolve. Mm-hmm. Fraud, right? So the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the established reference for psychiatric illnesses, first described these symptoms in 1994 as, quote, major depressive disorder beginning within 4 weeks of childbirth. The latest manual, published last year, said the symptoms often include, quote, severe anxiety and even panic attacks, and estimated that about half of what is considered major postpartum depression actually begins during pregnancy. Now, get this. This article, this author writes, depression in pregnancy can be missed because symptoms like trouble sleeping and moodiness also occur in pregnant women who are not depressed. And doctors have historically been taught in medical school that, quote, women don't get depressed during pregnancy because they are happy, end quote, said Dr. Catherine L. Wisner, a professor of psychiatry and obstetrics at Northwestern University. And so that misogyny of that women don't get, you know, that 1950s
right.
idea of just horrifying. But, it is interrogation, Jason. It absolutely
mm-hmm.
is. So
mm-hmm.
what are they going to be doing to this woman? A woman is having a panic attack now because she doesn't know, you know, economically and the social condition and war and
mm-hmm.
everything else in this world that she's bringing a baby into. And now all of a sudden that is a diagnosable,
yeah.
you know, psychiatric disorder that they're going to treat with drugs.
It's like they use like every device and every way to increase their I don't know what it is. It's like a net or something, and they it's just any it's like anything goes. You know, they'll do anything
yeah.
to try to create you know, situations where they can treat people, diagnose and then treat people. It's scary because that's what happens. In the beginning for me, and I'm thinking about this through my own experience, how, you know, just being put into the hospital, you know, it took 6 months to convince me that I was sick and that I needed to take medication for the rest of my life, and that I had you know, that I was manic depressive, and you know, and it can start with a you know, one of these interviews when you're, you know, having a life experience, a normal life experience, you know, pregnancy, and it's tragic, really, because you know,
it really
is tragic to hear about articles like that. You know, the New York Times on the front page, or it's just such baloney.
Yeah, and they say maternal mental illness is not new. It was recognized
right.
as early as the 5th century B.C. when Hippocrates
right,
proposed
right.
that fluid from
right.
the uterus could flow to the head after childbirth and cause delirium. And,
right.
and
well,
it's
that,
like...
That, I'm sure the same... You know, okay. The same,
yeah.
You know, there are similar theories today. That, you know, fluid
right.
to the head, humors, black humors and things. I mean, the theories they have today are no more absurd than the ones... you know, like that.
They're just better funded and have a glossier
yeah, yeah.
sales pitch.
Right.
I mean, you know, it's, you know, or after that, you know, you were a witch or a victim of some
right.
witch. Like, this is,
right.
you know, but then that article that Diane had posted about, you know, 42% of the population, of the American population, believes that we were created
yeah.
as we are 10,000 years ago. Like, that, this is, everybody's selling it. Everybody's selling this idea, and so it's easy to manipulate people who aren't really trusting of science, who are blindly trusting of science, and at the same time totally unaware
mm-hmm.
of
mm-hmm.
And that, I think, becomes where a big problem comes in of how is this, you know, how is this what we're going along? And then this coupling of the violence, you know, why did you need to throw in the you know, the horror stories if you're not
right.
trying to, you know, sensationalize and convince people, oh, yeah, this can happen, boom, boom, constant
mm-hmm.
reminder.
So,
but,
so what are we supposed to, I mean, what, you know, what are we supposed to tell people to try to convince them? You know, when I talk to people who work in the system and, you know, who use it, who they seem to agree with things I say about what you know, about the truth about psychiatry. They agree with it, and yet they still, you know, accept all these ideas that it's science and medicine, and I mean, and they have a right to do that. But what how do you undermine this, that kind of thinking? The only thing I can think of is
I think it takes time. I'll give you an example. I worked on a mobile crisis team over a year ago for Parachute. And at the time, the guy who ran the team didn't buy into anything I said.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, I met one of the psychologists who worked on the team with me at the APA protest. I ran into the director of that particular part of this mobile crisis team, which is Parachute New York City, today. And when I went into him, I said, congratulations, I hear you're a changed man.
Mm.
And I said to him, I hear you turned around and you now understand about the dignity of risk and the dignity of failure. And he did say he understood it. And he's had a change of heart. And then we talked about the fact that working in Parachute, that there's a certain amount of liability built in, and that if you're so liability-driven, there's no way that the program can be successful. You need to, the two things that we took out of Parachute, and normally when peers do rescue work, we have them in there, is suicidal thoughts and ideation and people who want to hurt themselves or others. That comes with the turf of doing real peer rescue work.
Yeah,
and
those aren't valid criteria for psychiatry. That's the scam.
Right.
That's not
that's
a valid
right.
criteria for psychiatry.
But what did you
right.
what,
Right, but Warren, because of the licensing that goes into for them, the two things that we removed from Parachute was you couldn't be suicidal or you could not be homicidal. Those two things, and being homeless actually disqualifies you from the opportunity to use Parachute.
But that's why the
service.
Whole thing is a fraud, Lester.
That's true, too. But what I'm saying is to change the culture even a little bit, minuscule, was like, forget about it. I got fired as a result of working on Parachute. And I didn't get fired because I didn't know what I was doing. I got fired based on politics because I understood that there was a certain amount of risk-taking built into this. Now, when we talk about risk, it's about the right and the dignity of failure. It's about treating people like adults. Like, you know, people have choices and they get to make them.
I like that a lot. That's what you said about, you know, the dignity of risk. I like that a lot. And, as opposed to, safety and at all costs, harming people, forcing people to be, ingest really harmful chemicals in order for everyone to feel, feel safe.
One of the things I have said often, Warren and I have some history, so Warren, witnessed me in a capability seminar when we first got there. I think it was the first one I sat in, and we began to talk about things, and I talked about the fact that we still do eugenics. We just do it on a much cheaper scale. It's easy to do it with the drugs. There's not one drug that doesn't have a sexual side effect to it. And if you think that's by accident, I don't think so.
It's really, Lester, I thank you for calling in with this article because it's really important that everybody knows. And I'm not exactly sure what's happened. It's supposed to be on the floor calendar on June 17th, so I'm not sure. The website hasn't been updated yet, but it may be too late already. But Bill Bill S7234B2013 relates to the provision of maternal depression education screening guidelines and referrals for treatment is the same as Assembly 9610B2013, and it's had multiple versions, and the sponsor is Liz Krueger. I don't know what Liz Krueger is thinking. Carlucci, Montgomery, Parker, Perkins, Serrano, and Sizek are all co-sponsors in the Senate. And the purpose of this bill, it says, well, the title of the bill is An Act to Amend the Public Health Law and the Insurance Law in Relation to the Provisions of Maternal Depression Education, Screening Guidelines, and Referrals for Treatment.
Yeah.
Purpose. This bill would define maternal depression, provide information and guidelines on maternal depression screening, provide information on follow-up support and referrals, and provide public education to promote awareness of and destigmatize maternal depression. In addition, legislation is intended to ensure that state residents are informed of the public health services that will help them understand, identify, and treat maternal depression. This is very dangerous, people, because there's also public health law that says if you have a psychiatric history, the state can take your child away from you for no reason whatsoever.
You're right.
This is entirely dangerous, and I can't, maybe on the assembly, maybe the assembly is updated, but I don't know whether or not it passed because it's not been updated. The last was amended on the third reading, and it was supposed to be on the calendar today, June 17th, 2014. And it says that it's possible the information isn't available yet for this session. And so it may be too late for women in New York State now. If you go to your doctor and your doctor thinks that you haven't, that you're too anxiety-ish or you're too panicky or you're not happy enough, because women are supposed to be happy when they're pregnant, I'm not saying that you shouldn't be happy, just to be clear. How are they going to
intervene? I mean, are they going to prescribe drugs to women before
while
they're still pregnant? What's going to happen?
I'm trying to get into the text of the bill.
Or I guess electroshock would you know, I know they do that, right? I mean, they say it's safe when drugs can't be used on a pregnant woman. But I don't think so.
Well, that's what NAMI promotes for bipolar.
Okay.
But it doesn't. I'm trying to Google. I'm trying to just do a word search. It doesn't seem to say just ECT or just electro anything. But it does. It says that one of the things it's going to do is define maternal depression. Why the hell are legislators defining? So what the hell is this? It says justification. Okay, ready? Folks, you're getting this at the same time I am. Maternal depression is broadly defined as a wide range of emotional and psychological reactions a woman may experience during pregnancy or after childbirth. These reactions may include, but are not limited to, feelings of despair or extreme guilt, prolonged sadness, lack of energy, difficulty concentrating, fatigue, extreme changes in appetite, and thoughts of suicide or of harming the baby. These reactions may occur without warning and may happen before, during, or immediately after childbirth and continue into the infant's first year of life. Okay, so despair, guilt, sadness, being tired, not being able to concentrate, like, whatever. So maternal depression, what's that?
But see, in my opinion, you know, women, the first year after their kid is born, there's going to be a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of, you don't think about the sociological changes that are coming with this. When a kid cuts teeth, when a kid has gas, if you have no partner and you're handling it all by yourself. I mean, come on now.
It goes on saying maternal depression may include prenatal depression, the, quote, baby blues, postpartum depression, and postpartum psychosis. Each year, approximately 10 to 15% of mothers and 22% of multi-ethnic inner city, what? I'm just reading here, folks. Multi-ethnic inner city mothers develop postpartum depression. 50 to 80% of new mothers will get, quote, baby blues, and 0.1 to 0.2% of new mothers develop postpartum psychosis. Postpartum psychosis, the most severe form of maternal depression, usually includes auditory hallucinations and delusions, and in some cases, visual hallucinations. Women whose maternal depression is severe enough to be considered postpartum psychosis have a 5% suicide rate and a 4% infanticide rate.
Okay. I'm thinking, what's next? You know, like fetal depression, fetal bipolar.
You kick too much. You must have oppositional defiance disorder. So it says often, this is the rationalization for legislation that may have passed today in New York State that I'm reading. Often the symptoms of maternal depression are not immediately identified because they closely resemble those generally associated with pregnancy. As a result, maternal depression is sometimes left untreated and may result in a detrimental impact on an entire family, especially the newborn and other children in the family. Children of mothers with maternal depression are at higher risk for serious developmental, behavioral, and emotional problems. The immediate family is often unaware and or unsure how to offer support. A mother experiencing depression does not often disclose her condition to feelings of shame, and the severity of the condition worsens. Maternal depression is often undetected and untreated by maternal health care providers due to both lack of training in identifying the condition and lack of support, both professionally and financially, as well as concerns about the availability of treatment options and coverage identified with maternal depression. Early screening and identification of postpartum depression has an 80 to 90% success rate and offers long-term health care cost savings. It also helps support healthy child development and addresses issues of early childhood mental issues of early childhood mental health challenges. Wow. New York, we are just in trouble. New Yorkers got to stand up. So the justification on Kruger's bill continues. Women typically visit their obstetrician and gynecologist during pregnancy and visit the pediatrician for their infant's checkups more often than they would any other health professionals. Therefore, these maternal health care providers are in an ideal position to screen women for maternal depression. Maternal depression is an epidemic that crosses racial, ethnic, and economic boundaries and requires increased education and screening to identify patients who need help. It also requires a high-quality network of accessible treatment options to deliver help and public support so that families and babies have a truly healthy start.
Ugh.
What a mess. What a mess.
That's why I let you know the article was out there.
I wish we would have known a couple of days ago. I really hope that this didn't pass. And I think that like a major education campaign, whether this passed or not, needs to be done. And there are plenty of people who are doing this. It's not like it's not being done. About the public health law that allows the state, New York State, to take your child away simply because you have a psychiatric history. If you'd like to call in and talk about this or anything else, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. Toll free, area code 855-346-3351. That's area code 855-346-3351. I also want to just remind people about a couple of events that are coming up. Lester, I'll be seeing you on Thursday.
Yes, you will be.
Okay, and we will be at 410 Winthrop Street. That is in front of Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room. On June 19th, that is Thursday, from 4 to 6 p.m., where we're going to have a vigil in remembrance of Esmond Green, who was murdered by neglect there 6 years ago. Lester, do you want to talk about that for a minute and your perspective of it and why you're so involved with this effort?
Well, I think for me it's about the fact that she was killed and nothing was ever really done. No one went to jail. You know, no one really went to jail. People may have lost their licenses, but nobody went to jail. And I, the way I see us is when this kind of stuff happens and the way we're treated is they treat us nothing more than cash cows and raw material and that they make money on. So what happens if some mental patient dies? Big deal. It's a mental patient. And I just can't condone any human being murdered, and then no one went to jail, really?
And covered up.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
People were indicted, but it was covered up. They falsified medical records, and if there hadn't been a videotape that happened to get leaked out, none of us would have ever even known this. I mean, that's the other side of why this is so important, because there's how many deaths a year are happening at Kings County and all over the world that nobody are being informed about. Exactly, because of what you just said. Oh, it's just a quote-unquote mental patient, nothing to worry about.
Right.
And so I think it's important that we, you know, keep on focusing on this and remembering Ms. Green, who her friends described as a beautiful woman. You know, some of the irony of Ms. Green's death, for those of you who don't know, she was an immigrant from Jamaica, and she had lost her job, and she was afraid that she was going to wind up not being able to support her home. And so she went to her pastor, and her pastor didn't know what to do because she was very distressed, and she knew she had a psychiatric history, so she called 911, And Ms. Green was transported to the emergency room where she was left to wait for 24 hours before she collapsed from her chair. A security guard is caught on camera sitting on a rolling chair, rolling to the wall, looking right at her, laying face down on the floor and rolling away. So how common is it that people are laying face down on a floor in an emergency room that nobody, like, moves when they see this? And then when help finally came, it started with a psychiatric worker kicking her, like prodding her foot into her. And then when she didn't move, they then realized that Ms. Green had died.
Uh-oh.
This is, and then they all started moving very quickly. And you can see it all on video if you Google Esmond Green, Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency Room. This was June 19th, 2008. That this happened. And so we the people in remembrance of Esmond Green formed after this and have been involved as an informal network and sharing information and working toward trying to have these things stop happening. The irony is that while Ms. Green, she was very active in her choir at the church and did a lot of volunteer work, and she used to go visit people at Kings County Hospital Center in the medical center and, you know, bring them, like, goodwill and go visit. And this is the same facility that left a volunteer of theirs dead on the floor for over an hour before anybody realized it while she was in an emergency room. Just horrifying. I'm wondering, Lester, Lester just got cut off. Lester, if you're still listening, call back because I was going to ask you something else. But that's June 19th from 4 to 6 p.m., 410 Winthrop Street. And then July 11th and 12th, there will be a gathering at the headquarters of the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance in Utica, New York. That's June 11th and 12th. If you're interested, you can contact me or the Alliance at area code 800-654-7227. That's 800-654-7227. And then July 13th through the 16th, beginning and ending at 6 p.m., the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day vigil will be held on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health. And we sit vigil for 72 hours to call attention to the fact that that's how long anyone in New York can be picked up, detained, assessed, and treated. And we hold the vigil to break the silence about psychiatric oppression and celebrate the human spirit. So if you're around Albany July 13th through the 16th, definitely come say hi. There will be people there for 72 hours. You don't have to stay the whole time, but, you know, for as long as you like, you're welcome to hold vigil with us. And then July 24th through the 27th is going to be the Mind Freedom Conference in Connecticut, and that's going to include keynote speakers, including Robert Whittaker, who wrote Anatomy of an Epidemic and Mad in America and has the Mad in America website. Mary Ellen Copeland from RAP Plans for Wellness Recovery Action Planning. And it'll have lots of information and separate tracks on Hearing Voices Network, Soteria House, Peer Run Respite, coming off of psych drugs, and open dialogue. And so if you're interested in any of that, that will be July 24th through the 27th. And then Youth Power University is going to be held at St. Rose College July 28th through the 31st. And they're going to have two different sessions, classes, one on peer advocacy and one on systems advocacy, and that also promises to be a great event. So there's lots going on, lots of ways for people to get involved and in touch. And if you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167, and the toll-free line is 855-346-3351. Lester, are you back?
Yeah, I got disconnected.
Okay.
But I will tell you that, you know, I think, you know, one of the beautiful things about the visual where we sit, you know, during July 13th and 16th is probably the most powerful version of peer support you'll ever find. It's probably the most powerful version because it takes place all hours of the day and night. We talk about everything and anything, from relationships to those of us involved in relationships to you name it, we deal with it up there. And it's really, and we do system stuff, and we talk sometimes at the State Office of Mental Health. It's really a powerful weekend. It's really a powerful few days.
It is a powerful few days. And one of the things that we always do during the vigils is reaffirm the Declaration of Principles from 1982 that we read the other night on the show. And I think it's important that people, you know, to really talk about the goals and the early days of the movement and what we're fighting around and the civil, constitutional, and human rights issues that are present, and that really speaking out against psychiatric oppression and reaffirming all of the work that people are doing. And it is a very intense and healing kind of experience. And I think it's one of the things that pushes me through every year, reinvigorated in those ways. Lester, I'm just wondering if you would be willing to talk a little bit on a personal level of why you get involved with things that are going on at Kings County Hospital.
Like I said, for me before, it's the fact that we're seen as cash cows. And it's whatever slaughterhouse they decide to send us to. And I think, you know, if you're gonna talk about, you know, here's what I will say. Even if you work inside the system, there always has to be a certain amount of advocacy and activism you have to keep involved in. You have to be part of. And that's sort of why I do it. I'm somebody who actually survived the original G building when it was
right.
The G building. Now they call it the R building. And same torch chamber, just different.
What is that? What is T building?
The G building of Kings County was infamous for really, really, truly torturing people. I can tell you back when I was first diagnosed, I spent a week in the G building. Because they were going to do a med change for me. I had been living with bipolar 2. And the upshot of that, it gave me nightmares for years afterwards. I remember seeing a woman tied in a straitjacket. And the nurses would peer over the nurse's station window and look at her as she was tied down in that straitjacket to that bed. And I remember being terrified of everything and anything, and just could not wait to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, the reason I do it is because I always think about the next person who's getting. I mean, the reason I do the work inside the system, I do it when I do it, is because I always think about the person who that night is being restrained and secluded, experiencing what I call a chemical lobotomy. The parent who's going to have their rights terminated next day, the person who's going to be court ordered to AOT, you know, these are the reasons I do what I do, you know, what
right.
I do. But I also, I guess, in many, many ways have hope that the system will eventually change, but I will say this, until the system is truly willing to address the coercion of the system, overt and covert, we've got a problem, a serious problem. And so that's why I do what I do. And the reason for making sure I'm always at Kings County is I would hope and pray to God that if someone killed me, that there would be a small group of people who are angry enough that would want to see some justice behind my death. I would hope, especially if a system killed me, you know. I've got my own set of horror stories, and in Devoiced, I actually talk about my horror stories a lot more.
What is that? What is Devoiced?
Devoiced was a a community-based participatory action research project that Warren Kenny did in the Environmental Psychology Department of the CUNY Graduate Center. And it turned into 600 pages plus, volumes 1, 2, and 3. And it takes you on this journey with us of what happens when we are silenced, when we're sitting at policy tables, how we're silenced when we're working inside the system. It's a call to action to change those things, because those things kill us more quickly than probably anything else does. It is that invalidation or that constantly saying, well, I have to play nice. I have to shut my mouth. I have to be quiet. And it's the voice that actually brings all of this to light. I was privileged enough to be one of the expert advisors and the first study coordinator brought on. So I've always felt like that's a big badge of honor for me. And for somebody who was told that they would never be a researcher, that they didn't have anything to bring to the table because they didn't have their degree, their this, their that, Lauren made damn sure that not only did people realize I had something to bring to the table, but that I had stuff to say. And that was really, really important for me. You know, that was really, really important for me. And so there were 37 expert advisors on 7 different continents that participated as we brought D-Voice together.
Because it was 36 expert advisors on 3 different continents. But yeah,
right.
it was quite amazing, and Lester's leadership in the project really helped form it into what it is, and it wouldn't be what it is without Lester having been involved. And I am eternally grateful to you, buddy, but I swear you make me crazy sometimes with some of the things you do. No, I'm sorry, you don't make me crazy.
You make me mad.
You make me mad. No, and I think that this is something that we're all up against, but I think that, you know, the horrors that you've been through in this system and the things that you have survived and are surviving are truly inspirational, and what you can offer people if you were allowed to do what was genuinely supposed to be getting done is amazing, and what you offer people despite the obstacles that you have for doing it is to be commended, and you really are a true advocate and activist, and I think people should know that. You know, part of what the D-Voice project trailed me through is some ancient history, like 19th century kind of history. And so I found this quote that was written by Commissioner Norris, who was the Kings County Lunatic Asylum Commissioner in 1875. So Kings County Hospital Center is Kings County Lunatic Asylum, same place, and building G, the old building that Lester talked about, was the actual old building of the Kings County Lunatic Asylum. And so Commissioner Norris in 1875 said, because there were reports of abuse being made by inmates, he said, "This sort of thing is very common among lunatics. They are always imagining themselves in great danger of being killed by their keepers." And so in 1875, this is how they talked about us, you know, that it's our imagination, our delusion that these people are trying to kill us, and it's not, and yet still we continue with having to defend ourselves at every turn. Area code 613, your line is open.
Hi, Lauren, how are you? It's Sue. Hello, everybody.
Hello, Sue.
Hi.
How are
I'm
you feeling?
Because, well, I have shingles, so I don't know if I should say it on the radio, but I'm in a little bit of pain,
ouch,
but it's starting to cure.
Yeah.
I'm calling with a very disturbing story. I didn't even know. Like, I went to the Ottawa Civic Hospital. I went to see my family doctor. And, a friend's daughter said, "Hi, Sue." I said, "Hi." She said, "I don't think you know what happened up here, eh? I mean, like, upstairs." I said, "What happened?" And my friend's daughter told me that a man, he went on the 6th floor to the outpatient psych ward, and he went into the door to see a psychiatrist. He came out. he went to the bathroom, and she was still in, and she heard a gunshot. And she jumped up and started to scream, it said in the paper, and she said, the man, he could have shot me. So a patient going to see a psychiatrist, after he saw his shrink, went to the bathroom and shot himself, killed himself. That's horrible. And then in January, at the Royal Ottawa Hospital, someone right in the hospital, well, what happened is they commit suicide. I wonder how often, okay, that this type of thing is happening with patients very distraught, coming out, and they kill themselves, okay, in the hospital, or they go out later and kill themselves. I don't know how often this is going on, but I know in Ottawa it happened in January and it happened in May. And I go to that hospital, and, I mean, the man was carrying a gun. I wasn't there on May 14th. I was there a few days ago to see my family doctor.
What happened in that room is all one can ask. Another perfect example as to how psychiatry does not have the answers for these.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I bet you can find some good statistics about, you know, suicide statistics, you know, within a year or so after their release, after being, you know, treated. So
We've been pushing in New York for them to start releasing the death numbers. And I was recently told by somebody who worked with the state that it would be too complicated. And I said, that's odd, because in 1851, it was routinely published in the Journal of Insanity as to what the death numbers were in New York State and the reasons why each person died. And so
there you go.
why they were able to, you know, that it wasn't so complicated in 1851, but it's too complicated now, remains. But getting accurate data, here we are again, Sue, same as electroshock, right?
Mm-hmm.
Who the hell knows what's going on, because they don't actually give the reflective data. And this is a problem. And then the idea that somebody, I mean, I understand, like, a concern for one's own life when they're near a situation of danger, but the idea that somebody would be more concerned about them having possibly been killed than the fact that while they're alive that somebody has just taken their life, their own life, you know, also adds to that kind of, like, where is the humanity here? Like, why isn't anybody questioning?
That's the problem with these places is that you create more trauma. You create, you know, I always say to people, you create a psychiatric survivor by the ill treatment that you give that person the first time you lock them up. And that's what creates the survivor, because now you say, never, ever, ever on my watch will I let this happen to someone else again. I will do everything I humanly can to destroy this system and break it. And that becomes the charge, if you will, to change how you do business.
How desperate can one feel to walk out of the place where you're supposed to be getting quote-unquote help to immediately then end one's own life? How often is psychiatry at the root of suicide?
Mm-hmm. True.
Well, I was at the hospital there a few days ago to see my family doctor. So Steve and I, we went up to the sixth floor, the outpatient psych ward, and, that it used to be, the apartment for, the diabetes, because I was up there. But I had a door for an elevator, because I'm in a wheelchair, and my husband went up the stairs, and he said, well, there's no one here, like, to help you, to go up. You know, I had to go into the elevator and help someone to push the button there at the other end on top.
Okay.
Wow.
But I want my husband to go in at noon tomorrow, because I have to go back again for my hearing test. I'm getting old. I'm falling apart, guys. Anyhow, I'm always there every week for something, eyes or whatever. Anyhow, to make a long story short, I want my husband, when there's no one around, to take a picture, to go upstairs and take a picture, of the area. When I went there, I went into the hallway, and I had a look upstairs.
Oh, somebody's got a lot of background noise.
Oh.
Sorry, go ahead, Sue.
Well, what happened is, okay, that I couldn't go up the elevator, and my husband went up the stairs, and I got a very eerie feeling being on that floor looking up the stairs. It was an awful, eerie feeling. I can't describe it, of a spooky feeling to think, you know, that a man had taken his life in there trying to get help. It was a very odd feeling. I said, Stephen, I said, I think we better go now. I said, I can't get up the elevator because there's no one to help me at the other end. And the feeling of this man, I don't know how old he was, it didn't say in the paper, to take his life, I mean, you know, that's a tragedy. That there, you know, it makes me sick to talk about it, actually.
It really is a tragedy. What a loss, you know. What could have been said to this person by this psychiatrist to prompt that experience? And then even further, why are we putting psychiatrists in a position of people who can tell who's a quote-unquote danger to self or others? They're oblivious. They have no idea whatsoever. They have no measures. They have no tests. They have no predicting ability. Quite frankly, this is the person who's supposed to decide, right? And that this person walks away and this tragedy of them taking their own life. But the psychiatrist remains oblivious. How is that even possible? That we're then trusting these people, that we're giving them this power and the ability to control people the way they do when they just don't have answers.
Well, I was going to see a psychiatrist, and I'll give her name. I don't know if I can on the radio.
Okay,
a doctor in Ottawa, seen a psychiatrist for years, and anyhow, downstairs, okay, they had a pharmacy, and I was there for 1 or 2 years. I went sometimes 2 or 3 times a week. I had a breakup of my second marriage, and my nerves were shot, so she gave me lithium and all these other pills, all different colors. I think I was taking 5 pills 3 times a day, lithium and the works. So I went downstairs one day. I said, hello, pharmacist, a nice young man, and he said, Sue, can I talk to you for a minute alone? He said, it's just between you and me, he whispered. I think you're taking a bit too much medication, just to give you, you know, a heads up. And I went home and I thought about it. I looked, I said, I got 5 of this and 4 of that a day and 3 of that and 4 of those. So I started to think, maybe I should get off the medications. About 6 months later, I got off the meds because a pharmacist gave me a little tip. He actually probably saved my life.
And what's that?
So then I got off the pills cold turkey, and it's not a good thing to do. And I was climbing the walls for a month. I was screaming, yelling. It was awful. My nerves were totally frayed and shot. I went cold turkey off the lithium and all that other stuff. It was awful. It was like the DTs. And I called, okay, a few places for the drugs, you know, the street drug rehab houses. They said, oh, Miss Clark, Mrs. Clark, we don't do psych drugs. It's only the, you know, the hard drugs like cocaine and, you know, marijuana and the other stuff. I said, well, I'm on psychiatric drugs. She says, I'm sorry, but we can't help you. I asked a few doctors. They said, family doctor, sorry, but we don't know nothing about that. So there I was at home, my cold, you know, cold turkey and driving my second husband right up the wall, and I was up the wall. And I got off. I had the sweats and the, you know, the dry mouth and just, like, rattled, and my nerves were shot. I was twitching, and I don't know if I had a seizure. And that happened for about a month. It was a terrible, terrible thing to do. And I don't think that, you know, a person should go cold turkey. I had no help, but, I mean, I think there should be more doctors, family doctors out there, I mean, to wean people off their meds, because
right,
a lot of
absolutely.
People want to get off.
It's dangerous coming right off, just going cold turkey like that, too. I didn't know back when I did it either. But there is things like the harm reduction guides coming off of psychiatric drugs put together by the Freedom Center and Icarus Project, and it's getting more attention now. But nobody talks about this withdrawal. Nobody, when people start taking these drugs prior to starting to take them, they're not told that the withdrawal from this is as bad as any street drug, if not worse.
Often worse.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's another issue of informed consent. that people aren't really being informed about what it is that they're doing to their bodies, and, you know, and especially when somebody may be vulnerable or in an extreme state or having, like, a real crisis of some sort, to be told by an authority of a doctor that this is going to help you, and then to learn all of the damage that it does only sometimes once the damage is done, it's criminal. It's criminal.
And I used to talk to my shrink and say, you know, doc, I really have to get off these meds. And he'd say, Suzanne, you can't get off your meds because remember the last time you tried to do that and you hung yourself and then you took all those pills and you went to the ICU and almost died. You can't get off those pills. So they scare you and they intimidate you. So you say, oh, my goodness, I can't get off those pills. You're right. I could, you know, try to off myself. Oh, my goodness. And I was like that for years, but 10 years, they scared me. I said, come on. I said, I don't want to take meds anymore. I get groggy. I can't see straight. I fall asleep on the bus. When I go to college, I can't even wake up. And the bus driver says, Sue, get off the bus. Your stop is here. You know, I used to be walking down the street, and I used to bump into a hydro pole, just walk right into it. I was groggy. I gained a lot of weight. And they have this system. Someone told me, a friend of mine, he went to med school, and he went to the Royal, and he became an intern for a few months. He said they have a system worked out. Scare the patient. And it's part of their protocol, medical protocol strength. The shrink students and the shrinks will say, scare the patient. And he actually heard that from a shrink saying, you know, sometimes I want to get off and do this, eh? He used to hear them talking, like in an office. He said it was horrible, but he used to laugh about the patient sometimes. He was in listening, you know, like he'd be sitting right next door and hearing, you know, because he was a medical intern. He said it was awful, the things he'd say about some of the patients, make fun of them. He said it was a horrible, horrible thing. And then he said that a lot of the psychiatrists got free trips and a lot of briefcases and pens and stuff, all from Big Pharma, you know, push the pills and we'll give you trips and that. But I think that's stopped in Canada now, all the gifts and that.
I just become more and more beside myself and the fear that they instill in people that this is, that if you don't do this, and I was subject to that for some time of where I really bought into it too, and I had a fear, and it's just not legitimate. And I don't know if you heard earlier, we were talking about what they're doing now to women who are pregnant. In New York, a law may have already passed today. I'm not sure. I just found out about it. About this mandated screening or screenings, and that the insurance companies are mandated to pay for it to women who are pregnant for depression screenings, and that they're extending postpartum depression to be something that can happen during pregnancy, and the evidence of it is extreme panic or anxiety. And so,
that's horrible.
Yeah, and so it's an entire population of people. And, Sue, because, like, the National Alliance on Mental Illness supports the use of electroshock for women who are pregnant who are diagnosed with bipolar, for example, like, how is this going to expand if every woman is going to be subject to depression screenings when pregnant? What does this do to women?
Exactly, and I mean, you know, I always call it, and I know I go this every time, Lauren, I hope I don't drive you nuts with this, psychiatric genocide. I always put it wherever I can, like in every comment, when, you know, there's death on a psychiatric ward or what happened when the Nazis did that to all the psychiatric patients or anything, because there's a lot of deaths in psychiatric quarters, okay, in the hospitals, out of the hospitals, okay? It's in the group homes. People, you know, go to group homes, psychiatric group homes, they can't handle it no more, okay?
Yep.
And I know we've known people that have committed suicide. I mean, I know about 10 friends that could not cope in any way, okay? My cousin committed suicide. He took a car from the Royal Ottawa, went to the Rapids, and that was it, okay? He had a wife who was pregnant and a girl who was 2 years old. He's about 30-some years old. Now, I know a lot of people, and I won't get into that story because my friends of suicide, because that's a bit traumatic for me. But I think we all know somebody or someone's cousin or someone's aunt or somebody that commit suicide. And that's a tragedy, okay? But a lot of the tragedy comes from psychiatrists. The psychiatric industry and big pharma are in bed with each other, so to speak, and they're making billions and millions of dollars on our lives and our friends' lives and our uncle's life and our grandmother's life and all our family's lives and our friends. And I call it a psychiatric genocide because of the stigmatization, the labeling of people, a group of people, and also the death from electroshock, from the drugging, the psychiatric drugs, and the shocking on the body. Like, you know, they take a rod and they shock all of your body. And I call it a genocide because it is. And people more and more are taking this seriously because if you look at a lot of the stats, there aren't many stats about, you know, like the deaths on the psychiatric wards, in the group homes, in that, okay? And even psychiatric patients in jail that are sent to jail, a lot of them are sent to jail, they hang themselves or they take, you know, or whatever. But the thing is, okay, this is very serious because a lot of this has been going on for more than 100 years. Okay? I know that electroshock started 70 years ago, but psychiatry has been from the 1900s, you know, the 1900s.
And even before that, yep.
Mm-hmm. And I know, Lauren, a few weeks from now, okay, like you're going to visit a museum somewhere, right?
Yeah, July 3rd, I'm going to the Glora Psychiatric Museum in St. Joseph, Missouri. And they actually have some of the old, there are a lot of, one of the commissioners there had tried to expose some of psychiatry's history. And with a group of inmates, wound up building replicas of a lot of the restraint devices that had been used.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also have a lot of authentic devices that were still used on display, and it's really a horror.
Wow.
It should be called the Gore Psychiatric Museum. But the curator there is really quite wonderful and open to our ideas, and so I'm going to you know, learn what she's done in the last year and talk to her about the outcomes of the research. And I think I'd love to have an exhibit on some of the psychiatric survivor history dating back to the 1850s that I found, and then obviously all of the modern movement of the 1960s forward, and getting that information there. And so I'm going there. And so anybody who's around St. Joseph, Missouri, it's not far from Kansas City, you know, feel free to contact me, and I set up an event page on Facebook.
Go ahead. Finish what you were saying. I was just going to say that, speaking of the, you know, history, when I was electroshocked at Pennsylvania Hospital, which is a really old teaching hospital, where that Benjamin Rush.
Okay.
I don't know if he started it or not, but Benjamin Rush is on the APA seal, who was one of the founding fathers. He kept his, I'm not sure if he invented the spinning chair or one of those restraint chairs.
Yeah, the tranquilizer, the tranquilizer chair.
And, but that's where I was held, and,
his face is still on the seal, right?
Yeah, his face is on the seal, and he kept his son there. His son, I think, was locked up there. His own son was locked up there for the last 20 years of his life, and I think he died there.
Yeah, and you know, Vanessa Jackson's also done a lot of work exposing Rush for his psychiatric diagnoses of people, of African Americans.
Right.
Really a horror that these are allowed to continue, that he's still allowed to be seen as a leader of this thing.
Yeah.
You know, the signer of Declaration of Independence also created the diagnostic term drapetomania. Anybody
right.
who doesn't know Vanessa Jackson's work, go read Vanessa Jackson's work.
Mm-hmm.
And so drapetomania, a disease that was assigned to African Americans who were in slavery for wanting to run free. It was now a quote-unquote mental illness. And I'm not sure if I'm saying this right or not, but dysgeusia ethiopica which was also commonly referred to, quote-unquote, rascality, which was a slave who broke his master's tools or didn't listen to him. And the cures for both Dravet's mania and dyschasia aviopica and preventatively were whippings. And so I think it's really important that people are aware of what the history is and what Vanessa Jackson calls scientific racism. I'm sorry, I messed that up. Rush wasn't Dravet's mania and dyschasia aviopica. That's Cartwright. That was Cartwright in 1851. Rush was a disease that he called negritude, which was the... sorry, I screwed this up. And so I'm just quoting from Vanessa Jackson here, who is quoting from Rush. So it says, Benjamin Rush, M.D., signer of the Declaration of Independence, dean of the medical school at the University of Pennsylvania, and the, quote, father of American psychiatry, quote, described Negroes as suffering from an affliction called negritude, which was thought to be a mild form of leprosy. The only cure for the disorder was to become white. It is unclear of how many cases of negritude were successfully treated. The irony of Dr. Rush's medical observations was that he was a leading mental health reformer and co-founder of the first anti-slavery society in America. Dr. Rush's portrait still adorns the official seal of the American Psychiatric Association. However, Dr. Rush's observation, quote, the Africans become insane, we are told, in some instances, soon after they enter upon the toils of perpetual slavery in the West Indies, end quote, is not often cited in discussions of mental illness in African Americans, however valuable it might be in understanding the traumatic impact of enslavement and oppression on Africans and their descendants. And then Cartwright went on to define negritude and dyschasia aviopica. And so Vanessa Jackson's work, and you can find her work at healingcircles.org, healingcircles.org, and she has also a piece called An Early History, African American Mental Health, on University of Dayton's website, and so you can check that out. But, this is the ludicrousness of it. And at that museum, at the Glora Psychiatric Museum, they actually have I believe it's an original version of the Utica crib that was developed in New York at the Utica State Lunatic Asylum, which was supposed to be a restraint-free environment. But Phoebe Davis, who is a lunatic liberationist in the 1850s, wrote about her experience in the crib and, really spoke out against psychiatry, well, what was then called the alienists, what psychiatrists used to be called, in two different books, specifically about the Utica State Lunatic Asylum in New York, which is now Mohawk Valley Psychiatric Center. And so I think the history, when we start to really look into where did this come from and how has this been organized and what is the credibility of them, what are they relying on as their quote-unquote science, we have to really ask serious questions about what we're doing as a society.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I have a beef with is when people go from the hospital and then they're put in a group home, often, okay, that the staff say, you have to take your medications. I've known some people, okay, that were kicked out because they didn't take their meds.
Yeah, the idea of compliance with a psychiatric regime as a mandate for somebody to have a home is just horrifying, and a group home at that. Not even, you know what I mean? Like, this is, it's slavery, and it's it really is a conspiracy because of all the profit and the organization, and they're all communicating with each other, and they're all continually writing laws that are specific to a section of the population. And last I checked, that was, like, not constitutional.
Mm-hmm.
But
and a lot of the prisoners going to court, okay, a lot of them, I think, have gone through the mental health system, and a lot of them are being put in jail, and they're caged again.
Right.
Okay, first of all, okay, they're caged by their medication, chemical restraints, electroshock, and then they do something criminal, like maybe they rob a bank or whatever. I mean, that's a crime, eh?
I want you to continue, but I want to just interject here. It's not just do a crime, because the warden of the Cook County Jail said that a lot of the people are there for things like trespassing because they were trying to find some place to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so it's not really the idea that, you know, it's not violent crime but just things that, and things that a pill are not going to fix. A pill is not going to give somebody a place to sleep. I'm sorry, please continue, Sue.
Yeah, and another thing I found very disturbing is when I saw pictures of spikes on the road, like spikes so that the homeless couldn't sleep. So some activist somewhere, I'm not sure where it was, they poured cement over it. And I thought, good for them, the activists. Because
yeah, that was pretty brilliant, right?
Yeah, and I said, don't put the spikes down. They need housing, not spikes. The homeless people need housing.
And you know, it just shows, like, how unfriendly the environment can be made for humans.
Yeah.
And that the government and private industry, certainly, are more than happy to make the physical environment a difficult place for somebody to even sit down, let alone sleep. And it's just inhuman. And our society is so backwards, and it really is very concerning as to what our future holds.
I think our society is uncaring. Not all people now, okay? I'm saying the people with the power, the ones with the in the government and that. And I always say that, you know, in Canada here, because I'm Canadian, that our federal government doesn't have a policy for housing. Now, okay, like if the USA government and the Canadian government put 1% of their federal budget annually, they could put housing up for all the homeless. If they choose to spend it on war, they tend to be corrupt with the money. When these poor human beings are being displaced on the streets and dying, and talking about homeless, I want to tell you two stories that are horrific, okay? There's a homeless lady in Winnipeg. She was sleeping. Somebody beat her up, and they're not sure what. She was so badly beaten that she lost one leg the one day and lost the other one in surgery. And then there was a man in a hospital. He was the same, like, okay, the Esmond Green story, okay? He's an Aboriginal. He was in a wheelchair, and he was an amputee, eh? He went into the emergency. He sat there for 35 hours, and nobody looked at him, and he died. All he had was a bad bladder infection, and that it was treatable. So his family are making a big outrage, and I think they should. They think that it's okay. They say that it was a discrimination because he's Aboriginal and because he was handicapped. He was there, and nobody took care of him. 34 hours just sitting there in a chair, double amputee. That's in Winnipeg, too. And the woman was in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. She was sleeping on the road. She's in critical condition, and she's clinging to life. It's just horrific. Like, all these stories that we hear, I was homeless, but I never sat. I only slept on the street once. When I was 17, I left home, my parents' condo. I slept on the cold ground in March. It's not a good thing to do. So I went to a stairwell, like an apartment next door. But I was homeless in Ottawa. and in Toronto, and I had some bad experiences, but I won't go into that. But anyhow, so, I mean, I got housing. I was a battered wife, and I got into Ottawa housing. It's not very good, but at least I pay $109 a month on a small check, but at least I have housing. It's not the best, but it's a roof over my head, eh? You know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really, it's really horrible to what they're doing to people, and I'm just a little late on the game here, but it seems that I'm just getting this information, the breaking news, a day late, a dollar short. So it looks like we lost. It looks like despite the efforts of people and hopefully people called, the New York State really, it seems that that there is a scam going on here. But it says that the Senate passes bill to close Brooklyn child stabber loophole. And so the conditioning of society of associating people with psychiatric histories and violent crime continues. And this was for immediate release June 16th, 2014. Bill would amend Kendra's law to require mental health evaluations for inmates with mental illness. You know, it's funny because when I was talking about this the other day, they didn't call it Kendra's law, and they didn't say it was amending Kendra's law. They just had it out as a separate legislation, but I guess, you know, that was the big concern. So the New York State Senate passed legislation today sponsored by Senator Kathy Young, R-I-C-Olean, that would amend Kendra's law to require all inmates with mental illness to be given a psychiatric evaluation to see if Kendra's law is appropriate before they are released. This crucial bill would apply to inmates such as Daniel St. Hubert, a paranoid schizophrenic with a history of violence who refused treatment in prison, was released without counseling or medication, and days later allegedly stabbed two young children, killing one and injuring the other in Brooklyn. And this, of course, is horrifying, and nobody's, you know, defending his actions. But the idea that because of this one person's actions, everybody who is in jail or prison is now subject to a screening to be put onto Kendra's law is really, really frightening. And it says, you know, down the line, it says highlights of Senator Young's bill include making Kendra's law permanent, requiring an evaluation for AOT, even if the inmate refuses treatment when mental health patients are released from inpatient treatment or incarceration, so that people needing services do not fall through the cracks. A scam. Requiring follow-up on those who move during the AOT period to ensure that people receive their treatment. And requiring the commissioner of the Office of Mental Health to develop an educational pamphlet on AOT process of petitioning so that family members have information on how to file a report. Oftentimes, loved ones are at a loss and feel hopeless when they about how they can help their mentally ill family member. And then it said this bill was sent to Assembly. So it passed. They held it. The last I was informed by Senator Skelos' office was that it was not going to go to the floor and that it was not going to be voted on. And that information that I got from Senator's office was apparently wrong. And it was voted on, and I'm now just trying to find out whether or not I can find where it's at the Assembly. This is really scary. Really, really, really scary. And so it's a big loss for, you know, we started off the show with a big win. Justina Pelletier will be back, returned home to her family by Wednesday morning, and the judge ruled that, and for every step forward, we go three steps back, I guess. And it's, you know, so it's saying that it passed, and I'm trying to find the Assembly's version of it.
Mm-hmm.
So if anybody's got anything to say about that, let me know. Maybe we can have some type of repeal campaign. It seems that the sponsor Rosenthal in the assembly, but I can't seem to find it. So you're just listening to me move through this. If anybody's got anything to say or would like to add about anything, we have a few minutes left. Sue, are you still there? Okay. So I think that this is the challenge we're up against, folks. We need to organize and speak out and make our voices heard in the mainstream media. I will be giving a more concrete update on this amendment to Kendra's law passing yesterday. And in the meantime, I'd like to just remind you of a couple of things going on Facebook. If you have not yet joined the Mental Health Civil Rights Protest page on Facebook, that is something that you might want to consider checking out and joining. There's a planning committee that's being created for a mental health civil rights protest in Washington, D.C. In the fall. And so you can get involved with that on the ground level, and you can find that at Mental Health Civil Rights Protest on Facebook. And then, again, the vigil for Esmond Green is going to be this Thursday, June 19th, from 4 to 6 p.m. at 410 Winthrop Street, Brooklyn, New York, and we will be remembering Ms. Green and all others who have lost their lives to psychiatry and who are currently struggling through. We'll also have a July 11th through the 13th will be the Alliance's gathering at the Alliance's headquarters in Utica, New York. And you can reach the Alliance at area code 800-654-7227, 800-654-7227. Mind Freedom International, and then July 13th through the 16th will be the 72-hour vigil on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health in Albany. July 24th through 27th is Mind Freedom International's conference. And you can find out information there at mindfreedom.org. And then July 28th through the 31st is Youth Power University of two courses, peer advocacy and systems advocacy for young people 18 to 30 years of age, I believe. And that will be held at St. Rose's College in Albany, New York. And so there's plenty going on. And if you're in Kansas or around St. Louis, Missouri, not St. Louis, Missouri, I'm sorry, St. Joseph's, Missouri, July 3rd, come to the Glore Psychiatric Museum and check it out with me. I want to thank everybody for calling in tonight. Was there anything else anybody wanted to say before we closed?
Yeah, okay, I wanted to just say something. I mean, I can't wait, okay, for June 26th, okay, to hear Dr. Bonnie Burstow talk about electroshock. I know her, and she's a real dynamic speaker. So I'm really looking forward to that. And I think this show is very important, Lauren, the show that you do, because people have to know the truth about psychiatry, big pharma, and, okay, like all of the other, the perpetrators of psychiatric genocide. I bring it up all the time. But, you know, this show is so important. I listen every night because I don't know a lot. I know some. I've been in this business 30 years. But I don't know a lot because I learn a lot from you, and all the speakers are so genuine and so sincere. I appreciate all the speakers and the guests coming on because and the callers because I'm learning every night so much, and this is important to my work because the people that share some experiences, I haven't had all those experiences, some, but this is a spectacular show that I'm going to spread all over the world because this is the best show ever, and I mean that from the heart.
Well, I appreciate it, too, and I appreciate so much everybody who is calling in and sharing all of this information and their strength and hope and you know, really informing people of what you have to survive. And I want to thank you for reminding me about to talk about June 26th. Because I don't know how I even forgot it. I'm so excited about it. From 8 to 10 p.m., it will be a special, and it will be a conversation with Dr. Bonnie Burstow. And Dr. Bonnie Burstow's work over the years on exposing the abuse and torture of people, particularly what women have endured at the hands of psychiatry, is expansive, and it dates back decades. Her work on exposing electroshock as a crime against humanity needs attention. People can call into the show to discuss the fight against psychiatry, the battle in academia, being silenced and obstructed, and strategic activism. Different efforts that Dr. Burstow has been involved in, including Psychiatry Disrupted, Psychiatry Interrogated, and Psychiatry and the Business of Madness, will be discussed. Dr. Burstow's bio is that Dr. Burstow is a faculty member at Ontario Institute for Studies and Education at the University of Toronto and a very long-time anti-psychiatry activist for approximately 35 years. She is also a feminist therapist, a prison abolitionist, a left-wing anarchist, and a prolific author. Examples of organizations and events which she has chaired over the years include the Ontario Coalition Against Electroshock, Resistance Against Psychiatry, the Coalition Against Psychiatric Assault, and the First Psych Out Conference. Examples of her publications are Radical Feminist Therapy, Working in the Context of Violence, Shrink Resistance, which she co-edited with Don Weitz, A Rose by Any Other Name, Naming the Battle Against Psychiatry in Mad Matters, and the much-anticipated and soon-to-be-released anthology of which she is the first editor, Psychiatry Disrupted. It promises to be just a super informative show with tons of information and real clear strategies of how people can have a successful career of in speaking out against psychiatry and strategies that people might want to consider taking on their own as they fight against psychiatry. And so that's going to be June 26th from 8 to 10 p.m. And, yeah, that's super, super exciting. Other shows that are in the works of being created include a show entirely about psychiatric power, trauma-informed care, involuntary outpatient commitment, psychiatry and children and young people, the dangers of psychiatric drugs, and suing your psychiatrist. And so there's really a ton of information that we're looking at. The open lines are fabulous, and I think that, you know, if you're looking to call in soon, you know, first-time callers are always welcome, as are people who call in regularly. I think that it's really working to expose people to information that they're not getting in the mainstream, and it's the mainstream media that we really need to start to alter and have our voices heard in. And so I thank everybody who called in tonight, Lester, Jason, Sue, and everybody who's listening. Jason, I'm just wondering if you have anything you'd like to add as a... I'm not sure. We might have lost Jason. He might just be listening. Thank you. Thank you again for participating and for calling in. And the show will air tomorrow night, Wednesday night, from 9 to 11 p.m. You can always listen to the archives at blogtalkradio.com/talkwithtenny. And if you have an idea for a show or would like to be a guest on the show, You can call the Talk with Tenny tip line at area code 718-273-8708. It's area code 718-273-8708. And that is the same line that you can also use if you want to report a human rights violation or a death that you know of that you think needs to have attention called to it or something that needs to be further investigated. You can also leave anonymous tips there. That's area code 718-273-8708. If you want me to call you back, make sure to leave your phone number. And again, thank you all for listening all night and every night. I'm going to ask you to keep speaking out until I talk to you next time. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.